Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, whenever you're listening, and welcome to Tri-State at the Plate. I'm your host, Andy Burdick, joined today by our former super producer, now newest staff dad, Jason Ruggiero. Jason, it is fantastic to have you back on the podcast. How are you today?
I'm good. It's good to be here. It's good to... Can you put in some, like, Rocky music?
That's
my game.
Yeah. The like, big... Is it the
Final
music?
Countdown, maybe?
The music from Rocky 1 or the Rocky music from Rocky 3?
I'll leave that up to you.
Okay. All right.
We'll see how it goes.
But yeah, no, it's seriously great to have you back. Things have been a little quiet on the Tri-State of Mind front, actually, for the last month between you having to pull some daddy duty, and then I had some wrist surgery that...
Yes, you were on the DL.
I was on the shelf for the last 3 weeks or so.
Surgery on your typing hand.
It was bad.
Which is both hands, by the way.
Yes, but on my dominant typing hand.
Yeah.
It was mostly inconvenient at work for writing on the board. That was not good.
Well, I thought you were going to say it's inconvenient for, you know, going after those little elementary school kids.
having to chase those little rascals down.
Couldn't put them in the full Nelson. You only go half.
Just the half Nelson. Yeah. So, but now we're back and healthy. We're about to have our first post in like 3 weeks. This podcast is going to be it. So,
slow clap.
Yes. I'm patting myself on the back here. Good for me for doing something in the last 3 weeks. But yeah, no, seriously, great to have you back, Jason. I missed you. I mostly missed our time together, our discussions. So basically, I'm just saying I'm really jealous of your son now.
Thank you.
He's taken all that time, all that Jason time that I used to get to myself is now going to your baby.
Pretty much.
I used to think that I was that baby in your life, and now I've realized I've been replaced by a real baby. Like
that
an actual
push you out of the nest, and, so to speak.
Yes. Baby Bird had to fly. Baby Burdick had to learn to produce his own podcast.
Yeah, he did.
Which led to two very frustrating nights and then two somewhat moderately frustrating evenings.
Yeah, it gets better.
It does. I'm getting faster. We'll see how long this one takes. Well, let's get right down to it today. Before we get started with everything, let's talk about Frank Wren being released from his duties. Nobody likes to say the word fired anymore, so I came up with a more PC term. He has been removed from his job with the Atlanta Braves, which his job was the general manager and is no more the general manager of the Braves. Jason, what do you make of this whole Frank Wren situation? What are your thoughts?
Well, I think that it's you know, we were talking about what to lead out the podcast with, and we decided on this not just because a good friend of mine who listens is a big Braves fan, but because the Braves are, you know, they're a flagship franchise, so to speak, of baseball, and they stink, and they shouldn't be this bad. But when you sign B.J. Upton and bat him leadoff, although he cannot get on base, you know, sometimes changes have to be made. Especially when your boss is the guy who orchestrated the Braves to what, like 15 consecutive division championships?
Yeah, he's probably not pleased with their 76-81 record at the moment.
Yeah. Well, so my friend who listens and is a Braves fan, I saw him last week, and he was complaining that the Braves bat their two worst players, numbers 1 and 2 in the batting order, and he surmises, or I don't know, I guess he's trying to rationalize it, that the only reason this could be is that they're putting them 1 and 2 so that Justin Upton bats behind them and protects them. like, we don't, you know, if we put B.J. Upton 7th, no one will pitch to him. But if we put him in front of Justin Upton, people don't want to face Justin, so they'll pitch to BJ. And I told him that Freddy Gonzalez actually is thinking so far ahead and out of the box that he doesn't even realize it. Like, he's really batting BJ Upton 8th, and the pitcher's batting 7th. And it's really just like, Yeah, he's flipping the lineup around, but he's trying to make BJ feel good about himself.
It's like an Inception with the batting order.
Exactly.
He inceptioned the batting order.
He countered that, well, then why do they get more at-bats than everyone else? And I said, that's just, we don't understand that.
It's beyond,
so next level.
It's beyond our mortal comprehension.
Right. And I think they figure, like, well, if we get two outs and then Justin gets on base, well, now we really got something going.
That's a very interesting take on that.
Well, I don't know what else it is.
Here's my conspiracy theory is Freddy Gonzalez is not a good manager.
That could be.
I'm going to go with that one. I mean, you look at Atlanta's lineup, and they should be better than they are, you would think.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You look at their outfield, they have Justin Upton in left, Hayward in right, you know, BJ Upton, I don't know what his deal is. You have to play him, I guess, so you don't have a choice. But, you know, you have the best defensive shortstop in baseball, Freddie Freeman, who, you know, puts up solid numbers every year.
Evan Gattis.
Gattis behind home plate. And then, you know, you've got Teherin, Minor in your rotation.
Minor stunk most of the year.
Yeah, Minor, he wasn't. He started to turn it around towards the second half of the season. And then, you know, you got Kimbrel at the end. You would think that Atlanta
They shouldn't be this bad.
Right, they should be better than they are, you would think.
Maybe Manny Acton will get this job.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, because what I'm saying is, like, I didn't think Manny Acton was that bad of a manager. I think he had a crappy team, both in Washington and in Cleveland. You know, you feel bad for those managers because, like, everybody has to start out. Nobody, like, unless you're Joe Girardi, like, gets the Yankees right away, you know?
Right.
So you hope that those kind of guys, like, get a decent chance someday.
I like that. Manny Acta to Atlanta thought. I like that. That's interesting.
Or, and this will really make Lucas mad, what about Dusty Baker?
Dusty Baker, yeah. all those pitchers just suddenly cringed.
Yeah.
They were all just terrified of that.
Oh, and the Braves always have such a good farm system, and Dusty Baker has just a blatant disregard for anyone that comes up from the farm system. He'd be perfect then.
He would run out 9 Emilio Bonifacios before he called up someone from the farm system to help out.
Yeah, Tommy LaStella, get out of here.
Get out of here. We got Emilio Bonifacio 2. That's just playing your position.
No, Manny Acta, that's my...
All right, so if we take anything away from topic of the day, it's that goodbye Frank Wren. You did an awful job with the keys to the car. And Manny Acta, welcome to Atlanta. Before Freddy Gonzalez has been fired.
To clarify, Freddy Gonzalez has not been fired yet. Although they're saying they're going to give John Hart the GM job. John Hart's pretty smart. I don't know why he would keep Freddy Gonzalez, but we'll see.
Interesting. Yeah, good luck, Braves fans. Let's move on to some baseball that matters now, though. That was my little dig at some Braves fans there.
Yeah.
Because, actually...
Yeah, they got it.
If you hear me... disclaimer before we get talking about things today. If you hear me scream in the middle of this podcast, the Pirates are playing the Braves right now. It is the bottom of the first. And Jeff Locke is currently throwing to Justin Upton. So... That's
two outs.
Two outs, yep, that's where we're at in the game right now.
Alright, now we're going to get something going.
So, let's see what we got going on here. Today we're going to talk about the Pirates. Lots of stuff to talk about with Pittsburgh. Then we're going to move on to Cleveland, and we're going to talk about what's going on in Cleveland. Some things still happening in Cleveland, baseball related. And then we will we'll wrap up with some tweet mails. We have a long-awaited tweet mail from Dan in Buffalo, so...
Do you have ants in your pants? Because there's, like, a lot of noise on your end.
A lot of noise.
Like, rustling. It's like you're wrestling an octopus.
No, I am sitting here in the basement.
I'm saying it for the sake of the listeners, so maybe
yes.
You can figure it out.
Listen, Jason, I am not a super producer. The listeners are going to get this quality. Sorry, listeners.
Whatever you're doing, right? right now. Keep doing it. Stopped.
All right. Well, I will continue to not do that. I don't know what it is. Now I'm scared. I'm not moving at all. All right. Pittsburgh. Today, Jason. The Pirates are in the playoffs for the second consecutive season, thanks to a victory in Atlanta last night against the Braves. So what that means, Pittsburgh is guaranteed the wild card game. With that victory last night and the St. Louis loss, however, they are still 1.5 games back of St. Louis in the division. So it's a stressful last couple games here, coming down the pike with Pittsburgh and St. Louis so close together.
And wouldn't it be nice to not have a one-game playoff?
Let me tell you, playoff baseball was great last year. Don't get me wrong. I enjoyed the Cueto chants. It was very, very intense. I'd never want to experience that level of stress again, though. I don't know if my heart has it in me to physically hold up another one-game playoff. I might keel over in the middle of that playoff. I'm not sure. I would love to win the division. I saw the projected chances of Pittsburgh winning the division 7 days ago, and it was at 15%. So the projectionists out there were not feeling great about Pittsburgh's chances of winning the division. And I will say, full disclosure, their chances of making the playoffs, whether it was winning the division or the one-game wild card at that period of time, were 90%. I don't know. I mean,
chances are they're going to be in a one-game playoff.
That's what it's looking like, and it's probably going to end up being against the San Francisco Giants. That's what we're probably looking at right now, just with the last few games left. Which, as we talked about before we started recording, is not, like, the worst thing in the world, because Pittsburgh is playing some great baseball right now, and San Francisco is not playing such great baseball right now. And, I mean, when it comes down to this point in the season, you want to probably be betting on the team that is playing the better baseball to win a one game like that. I mean, one game is such a coin flip in baseball, it's tough to say. I guess I would feel more comfortable if I were a wagering fellow to wager on the team that is playing better baseball.
Yeah, generally.
So,
but you never know.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I live by this rule also. You never bet on baseball, because anything can happen. Like the Phillies, for example, could go play a three-game series against the Dodgers in the middle of the season and win, you know, 2 out of 3 in Los Angeles, because that's just baseball. That's how it happens. The one-game playoff probably going to happen. So it'll be interesting to see. Keep your eye on the rotation and just kind of see how things are going to end up lining up. I'll be curious to see down the stretch whether, you know, pitchers are getting positioned for that or what hurdle strategy is going to be.
Yeah, who would be your guess as to who's going to start that game? I mean, there's, what, 4 games left, right?
We have, well, tonight and then tomorrow with Atlanta. And then 3 games with St. Louis. So we have 5, including tonight.
So, who pitches tonight?
Tonight we're with Jeff Locke. So, Garrett Cole was last night.
So, Jeff Locke is lined up to be...
Right, which that's what I mean. Like, somehow
obviously
I think you...
that's not going to happen.
You're figuring out how you get Garrett Cole to start that one-game playoff if it comes down to it. So, that's what... I mean, it'll be worth watching over the next couple days to see how Hurdle kind of jockeys with that rotation to get guys lined up where he wants them to be. Now, speaking of Garrett Cole actually was on the bump last night. So I don't know if in between bottles and diapers you had a chance to see what Garrett Cole did last night. But
no, I didn't.
It was a pretty good start, and it didn't start off as such a great start. Actually, I had on my phone a text message pulled up. My phone has since turned off. I believe the gist of my text message at the beginning of Garrett Cole's start to a friend. Actually, here it is. Let me get this pulled back up here. said, if Garrett Cole throws like this, it's going to be a long night. Come on, Garrett.
He gave up, what, 2 earned runs right out of the gate,
right? Oh, boy, yeah, 2 earned runs right off the bat. But really, he settled down, you know, after the second inning, he settled down. He retired his last 17 batters that he faced against the Braves. He ended up throwing 7 innings, only giving up those 2 earned runs, struck out 8, finished with 4 hits and 2 walks. I mean, he really minimized that damage in a game that looked like, at the beginning, things were going to get out of hand. And he ended up really turning that start around and pitching some big, meaningful innings for Pittsburgh in that game.
You know what that start kind of sounds like?
What?
Kind of sounds like a start by his old buddy Trevor Bauer. Really rough out of the gate, and then he pulls it together.
And then he figures out what's going on.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, that's what you're looking for from your big horse, you know? Sometimes you get off to a rough start, but you got to reel it in and keep your team in the game before it gets out of hand.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, when you have the talent that Garrett Cole does, you know, he goes out there and he pumps an easy 94, 96. You want to keep that guy out there as long as you can. And he started to utilize his curveball, and that was really when I noticed he was starting to get hitters off balance last night. You know, his curveball started to look pretty sharp, and that seemed to throw the hitters off a little bit once he started utilizing it. So it was nice to see him make some adjustments and keep himself in the game and stay out there and pitch those. You know, that's the kind of start that you want a guy like Garrett Cole to make. You know, when you see Garrett Cole come up last season and do what he does, you want him to be the guy that's pitching in those games last night, the game that's clinching the playoffs for the team. So it's good to see him go deep into a game like that.
Yep.
So Pittsburgh has 2 more games with the Braves. So they have the game that is currently underway right now, which is still 0-0 in the top of the second, in case you're wondering. And then they go finish in Cincinnati. They have 3 games against the Reds to finish the season. So it would have been kind of nice if St. Louis had been that last team on the schedule to give Pittsburgh a little bit of control over their own destiny. But right now they're just kind of – they have to take care of their own business, and their playoff hopes kind of rest on the mercy of how well St. Louis plays going down the stretch, which – I'd never really realized before, because in the, you know, 20-some-odd years that I've been watching baseball and understanding kind of what's happening, I've never had to experience, like, playoff-related things. So it's, it's kind of peculiar to be like, well, I mean, there's nothing we can do about this. We just kind of have to wait for St. Louis to lose some games. It's a very odd feeling to be worried about things like that. So Pittsburgh clinches this playoff spot last night, though. And so I wanted to get your opinion on this, because I was just kind of curious your take on this. The big thing in baseball seems to be these champagne celebrations. You know, they have the traveling guys with the club that they're basically their sole job in the days leading up to when a team clinches a playoff spot is to basically make the room look like Dexter is conducting a murder in there, and line everything in plastic so they can roll in some giant coolers of champagne and Bud Light and let players throw it all over each other. And I'm very curious about your thoughts on this, because I have a feeling, based on our lifelong or our interactions with each other over the last few years, that I have an idea of where you're going to go with this. What do you think about the celebrations when teams clinch a postseason berth?
I think they grow tiresome. Like, even in my team, even last year with the Indians, you know, they hadn't made the playoffs in a while. Those particular players, many of them had never made the playoffs. And, like, so it was nice to see Jason Kipnis all excited and spraying champagne, but then after about 30 seconds, it's like, okay, that's about enough of that. We can see that you all look like fools with your goggles on in your Dexter room, and
I think that the traveling secretary guy, the guy that has to do all that stuff for these teams, you know, like when they're on the road especially, that job I think just has to be awful. Because you have to have all that stuff, like, you have to be able to set it up really fast. But then you have to be able to, like, wheel everything out really fast, depending on how the game ends.
You know who's the most famous traveling secretary of all?
Who's that?
George Costanza.
Costanza!
That was his job with the Yankees. I think he was assistant to the traveling secretary. That's who's probably setting up the room.
Costanza.
The assistant to the traveling secretary.
Yeah, the traveling secretary is probably busy getting his goggles on as well. Which, actually, last night for the Pirates, he did have his goggles on last night, and they were dousing him with champagne and Bud Light.
I just think it's, like, it's tiresome. That's how I feel about it.
I'm going to take the counterpoint to your point, and I mean, maybe it's because I'd never experienced playoff baseball until last season, but. Well, I shouldn't say that. I mean, I had in, like, 1992 when I was 10. I kind of enjoy it. I thought it was fun. I stayed up an extra hour or so later than I typically would have to watch Tony Sanchez, you know, double-fisting Bud Lights and just throwing them all over the place in the locker room. You can tell that they have a very interesting relationship with Robbie Kaminsky, the Pirates in-game announcer guy. He they just didn't stop spraying him the whole entire time he was trying to talk to people. they talked to John Holdscombe, the Pirates up and coming relief pitcher who was pitching in the Indy Leagues at the beginning of this season. Who's now, like, pitching super meaningful innings. And it was neat to see him. You know, he was a guy you could tell, like, in his life, he was totally unprepared for a moment like this. Like, he was not a guy who had spent time thinking about how to address questions of, you know, pitching games in front of 40,000 people that have playoff implications.
Yeah.
So it was kind of cool to see. I enjoy it. And it's one night. So as long as they get a good night's sleep and they aren't hungover the next day, I say celebrate that, but let's get back to business now.
There you go.
That's my managerial PC answer for that.
Uh-huh.
Celebrate away. So there was a topic today that I thought was kind of interesting that I wanted to bring up with you. I heard it on Pardon the Interruption today, and you hear it all throughout. Any media that talks about baseball is probably at some point going to mention it, but Michael Wilbon had talked about today how games are more meaningful in September than in April, and for the life of me, this sentiment of how games matter more at the end of the season than at the beginning of the season, it drives me bananas. It really does. Maybe it's because, like, now I'm seeing how things are shaking out in Pittsburgh. But, for example, I think back to, like, the four games that Jason Greeley blew earlier in the season before he was traded to the Angels. How much I would love to have just won two of those games instead of four. And the position that we would be in. And I get that baseball's a grind. It's 162 games. And that in April you really have no idea where you're steering your ship. But I really think all of these games matter. I don't like the sentiment when people in the media say, like, the games in September are more meaningful than April, because I don't believe that. What say you about this, Jason?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. They mean more in the sense that you're getting down to the wire, just like, you know, the 10 minutes before your job interview more than the 10 minutes you had the night before. But it's so easy, I think, too easy to write off the beginning of the season. And don't get me wrong, I'm a big believer in, you know, you have to let players get to their mean. You can't overreact. Like, when a guy goes 0-for-30 in the first, 2 weeks of the season, that doesn't mean he stinks. But when your bullpen is imploding left and right in, say, April, May, or June, those wins matter just as much to the final outcome. I'm trying to pull up a stat about the Indians' blown saves, but Fangraphs is, like, really not cooperating right now. because I think the Indians have blown an inordinate amount of saves. Let me try to find it. And it'll illustrate your point, because here we are. We're sitting, 3.5 games back of the Royals, basically eliminated. If we lose one game, our elimination number is one. So if we lose one game, we're done. If we win out and everybody else loses out, we tie. And here we're talking about a team that has blown... in the last month they've blown at least, I think, 5 saves in the last 3 weeks. That doesn't even count the whole season.
Right.
Here we go. The Indians have blown 23 saves this year.
And imagine if you just got a fraction of those losses turned into
wins. The league average, according to this article, is 18. Okay? So, say you just wipe out 5 of them. All of a sudden, we're a game and a half up on the Royals.
And you're probably feeling a lot better about that.
Say you have a really good bullpen, and you only blow, say, 15. Now we're... that's a 10-game or an 8-game swing.
Right.
And a lot of those came in the beginning of the year, with John Axford or with, a tired Brian Shaw after, there was back when there was only like 3 decent relievers in the bullpen. But those losses matter just as much.
Right. Yeah, so that always bothers me when I hear... I feel like if you watch baseball, and it's not that I just watch baseball exclusively, but I watch more baseball than I do any other sport. And I feel like people who intimately watch baseball, who watch baseball a lot, have a better understanding of just how important those games are.
Right.
Or how, I guess, how to value those games, at least.
I think what's different is, in football, there's no... You can't take anything for granted. There's only 16 games, It's like you always hear in football, there's no bad win.
Right.
You get the win, you move on, try to correct the problems for next week. In basketball, for sake of argument, I think it's a lot easier than in baseball to turn it on and turn it off. Because players don't get in these long slumps in basketball.
Right.
LeBron James might have a bad game, but he probably doesn't miss every shot for 2 weeks.
Right, yeah.
Well, in baseball, it's entirely possible that a really good player could not get a hit for 2 weeks. So, I think it's easier in basketball for a good team to kind of coast at .500 and then the last 2 months be like, all right, let's go. Time to win some games. But it doesn't work that way in baseball.
Right. That was very eloquent, Jason. This is why I'm happy to have you back.
Hey, what can I say?
I missed you.
That was all off the top of my head.
That was good. That was really good. So, safe to say, games in April matter as much as games in September?
Yes.
All right, people, ignore those talking heads. Listen to us. We're here to speak the truth. So, last thing I wanted to talk about before we moved on to Cleveland, and I'm kind of curious to see your take on this, having been a new dad over the last few weeks. So, I want to talk about who the Pittsburgh Pirates MVP is this season. Now, last season, I brazenly identified Russell Martin as my midseason MVP before crowning Andrew McCutchen as the actual MVP across the board for the full season. Now, this season, at the All-Star break, I could no longer deny the greatness of Kutch and make my trendy hipster pick of somebody other than Andrew McCutchen, because McCutchen's numbers were just that good.
Right.
So, but, you know, here's the thing this season. Kutch missed a few weeks. He had, you know, some of the rib issues, the intercostal issues, of which I am familiar with. And he had to miss some time. So if you had to crown someone the Pittsburgh Pirates MVP, Jason, would it be someone other than Andrew McCutchen?
Well, I'm trying to go around the diamond in my head. Obviously, they have no first baseman to speak of.
If we combined Gabby Sanchez and Ike Davis?
No. Neil Walker's been good, but not that good.
Yeah, he missed some time with an appendectomy.
Shortstop, no. Third base, well...
Things get a little spicy over there, don't they?
The person who started the season at third base is no MVP, but the person who replaced him, maybe.
That's kind of the trendy hipster pick for Pirates MVP. That's the right. The Russell Martin of last year, if you will.
Well,
what do you think about Josh Harrison?
I mean, isn't he like in the race to win the batting title?
Yeah, he's like right up there with Kutch.
I mean, this isn't going to continue, right? Like, do you really think that Josh Harrison is this good?
No, I don't think he's this good. I think this. Can I tell you what this season really reminds me of? It reminds me of the season that Jack Wilson had when he was the batting champ. I always think it's funny they call him the batting champ, like they just the guy who hit for the highest average. But whatever. But yeah, like Jack Wilson won the batting title one season with the highest batting average in the National League, and this kind of reminds me of that. Although you know, you look at Josh Harrison, and you know, he's entering his age 27 season. You know, that's when people seem to postulate that players kind of maybe hit their stride. He's a career 283 hitter. The biggest thing that has changed has been his ability to get on base this season. He's just getting on base at such a higher clip. You know, he's getting on base. He has a .348 on base percentage. Relative to his .314 career on base percentage,
I'm gonna throw an off the wall, a dark horse, you could say.
Okay.
Because he was instrumental in the Pirates' season not imploding early on. Mark Melancon.
You're going with the closer for the team MVP, huh?
Their bullpen stunk.
Their bullpen did stink. Well, yeah, their bullpen did stink.
What I'm saying is, I guess my point, I'm not really, you know, arguing for Melancon. I'm just saying, as far as value to the team, with all the upheaval and ineffectiveness that was going on in the bullpen, you can't dispute, right, that he had an enormous stabilizing force.
He did bring some stability to that bullpen. That is a very, very good point. Yes. When you're talking about the inconsistencies of like Jason Greeley or Justin Wilson this season to a degree, or you know, some of the other components of that bullpen. Yeah, that's actually a very interesting point, Jason. I like that.
I mean, I probably would go with McCutchen, honestly.
I think it comes back to that. I think if you're going to make a trendy hipster pick, you could make a fairly good argument depending on, and this goes to your interpretation of the term most valuable player.
Right.
I think you could make an argument for Josh Harrison because he stepped up and began playing exceptional baseball at a position that had...
been a black hole.
Yes, had near replacement level value at third base. So I think you could make an argument for Josh Harrison, but it's McCutchen. I mean, I don't see how you pick against Andrew McCutchen as the Pittsburgh Pirates MVP when he could in theory be the MVP of the league again.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, he's hitting .314 with a .409 on base percentage, 24 home runs. He's tough to pick against, statistically speaking.
I traded him in my fantasy league.
Oh, that was not it. I wish you would have called me first so I could have advised against that.
No, I was out of it. I traded him at the end.
Oh, okay.
And the person in second place for Paul Goldschmidt and Will Myers.
Is that a keeper league?
Yes.
Okay.
And Goldschmidt was $12 and Myers was $2 and McCutcheon was like $47.
I can get on board with that.
Yeah.
That's value, baby.
Yeah, I wasn't going to go anywhere, so I needed that big bat, you know?
Yeah, make the move. I respect that. And I respect that player playing to win now, so good for him.
Yeah.
Good move for everybody. Well,
enough about my mediocre fantasy.
Yeah, because everybody loves hearing about everybody else's fantasy baseball team, don't they?
Oh, it's the best.
So, all done with Pittsburgh. Anything else Pittsburgh related that you would like to chit chat about?
No, just, you know, right now, if things remain the same, you'd play the Giants, correct?
Yeah. Yep. So we get the Giants in that one game wild card. I believe. We actually have the tiebreaker over the Giants, and I'll have to double check that, but so even if we ended up, with the same record, we should be hosting the games. So as long as we finish, ahead of the Giants or tied with the Giants, we should be hosting that wild card game.
Yeah. Well, the Giants have been, I think they've lost like 7 of their last 10, so.
Which that's good. Atlanta has taken a 2-0 lead on Pittsburgh, which is not good.
No.
So, moving on, Jason, let's keep the ball rolling here. Let's talk about what's going on in Tribe Town.
Well, the Indians are on the brink of complete elimination from the playoff race. Like I said, they have a magic number of... They have an elimination number of 1. So, if they lose 1 game, they're out.
That's like the anti-magic number.
Right, so they would need to win out while, say, the Royals, for example, lost out, and then hope that even still the Mariners don't end up with a better record than them.
That's a lot of hoping.
Still in front of them. So, it's not good. Cleveland's playoff chances are not good right now. I don't know what the score is right now in the game. It will probably freeze my computer if I tried to check. on a positive note, something to watch here at the end of the season is that Michael Brantley, who of course would arguably be the Indians MVP, unless you're going to go with the Klubot. He is 4 hits and 3 RBI away from becoming only the 3rd player in Indians franchise history to have a season where they have 200 hits, 30 doubles, 100 RBI, and 20 stolen bases.
Wow.
So, the two other, just for sake of reference, the two other players in Indians history are Joe Carter and Nap Lajoie. That's from 1904. Carter's from 1986.
Yeah, you're going back for Nap Lajoie, huh?
Yeah, and just for frame of reference, the last two players in the majors to have a season like that are Jacoby Ellsbury in 2011 and Ryan Braun in 2009.
Oh my.
So Mike Brantley is having a really good season.
Yeah, that's a phenomenal season.
Yeah, I mean, if you actually read off all the numbers, not just some of those counting stats I had there, he's had 20 homers, 97 RBIs, 93 runs, 23 steals, 327 average, a 385 on base, and a 507 slugging. That's pretty good.
That's a great season.
Yeah, especially when they just locked him up on a really team-friendly deal before the season.
Oh, man, that looks like a genius move right now, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. As does the extension to Yan Gomes, who's really kind of straightened himself out both offensively and defensively, and is got to be in any conversation for the best catcher in the American League. I mean,
Yan Gomes has hit his 21st home run of the season tonight.
I was going to say, prior to tonight, his stats were 20 homers, 71 RBIs, batting 282 with a 473 slugging. And Fangraphs has him as a 4.6 WAR. So that's pretty good. Just one other player to note is Carlos Santana, who, of course, we bled a lot of digital ink on early in the season.
Yeah.
His average is still awful, okay? I mean, he got, you know, baseball gets to the point. There's not much you can do about your average after a certain, after July or August.
Right.
He's hitting .232. But he still has that amazing .364 on base, 130 points higher than his average.
Ridiculous. And can we remind the readers, do you remember my theory on what a good on-base percentage is relative to your average?
Go for it.
If your on-base percentage is 100 points higher than your batting average, you are having an incredibly productive season.
Right.
As far as getting on base is concerned. Your ability to get on base is very, very good. So his on-base percentage is 30 points higher than that.
Yeah.
That's a phenomenal ability to get on base.
While, again, he's not getting a lot of regular hits, but while posting that .364 on base, hitting 27 homers and driving in 82 runs.
Yeah, I mean, he's...
That's a good season, especially for how rough it started.
Right. I mean, he almost has as many walks as he does strikeouts.
Right. He's one of the league leaders in walks, if not the leader. It changes. For some reason, Fangraphs tonight doesn't want to give me league stats. But he's up there, regardless. He has a 17% walk rate.
Yeah, that's really good.
So those are kind of the good things, you know. And we know, like, Lonnie Chisenhall had a really good start to the year, faded, and now he's actually kind of brought it back a little. So it'll be interesting to see what he does next year. I was want to get into the starting rotation, but since we're talking about batters right now, a discussion I think we want to start having, and it'll probably continue throughout the offseason, is what do the Indians do with Jose Ramirez? Because he's shown, I think, more than a lot of people thought. He's holding his own at the plate. He's batting .250, but that is kind of skewed because when he's called up earlier in the year for a few weeks, I think when he was sent back down after that, he was batting like .080. So he's batting like 80.
Yeah.
So that's numbers off a little, but still .250 for a shortstop in today's league is really a strong number. I mean, in the limited time, he's only had 250 at bats and he has a 1.4 WAR.
Yeah,
of course,
I mean,
you have Lindor sitting there.
Which, and that's going to be, and that was going to be my next point to actually bring up. That's going to be the problem with, and we've talked about this extensively on the podcast and in our articles and with, you know, your projections for, you know, the farm system prospects, is that Cleveland has such a large group of infield prospects. They're like having to move guys to other positions now.
Right.
And that's Jose Ramirez's problem, is he's not your typical stopgap shortstop like Asdrubal was.
Right.
You know, he's a little more talented than that, it would appear.
Exactly. And I mean, even more so, the argument always with Jose Ramirez, as it approached, you know, this current situation, like, everyone could see, like, Asdrubal's gonna leave, Lindor might not quite be ready, they'll bring up Jose Ramirez to fill the gap. Well, what everyone's been saying since Jose Ramirez has been in, like, Double A is he he's really a second baseman. He's only kind of a stopgap shortstop. Well, he's proven in the last couple months that that's not really the case. Like, he's proven that he can be a good shortstop defensively. So, I mean, I don't see how Lindor breaks camp with them with all the contract, you know, financial super two mumbo jumbo that I hate and despise. But with Lindor being a franchise type player and Ramirez playing so well, there's no way they're going to start the year with Lindor. I mean, it's just, it's already ruled out. You could see it by the fact that they decided not to call him up.
Right.
For September. They didn't even want to give him a month of service time. With Kipnis' struggles, though, this year, it makes it so tempting. The way the Indians' defense is so putrid, doesn't it make it so tempting, though, to send Jason Kipnis back to the outfield and at some point have an infield with Lindor at short and Ramirez at second?
And then, so, are you sticking Kipnis in left field? Are you sticking Kipnis in
right? Well, he was a left fielder in college.
So that's where we're sticking him. So, you know, his bat doesn't play as well in left field, especially if his power numbers are down. You know, now how much of that is, you know, the abdominal injury that's been dogging him allegedly all season or what, we don't really know.
And now there's all these reports which weren't around in spring training, but all these reports that basically Jason Kipnis showed up really out of shape to spring training, and that's where all these problems started. So who knows about the power numbers?
So is Jason Kipnis your team's Pedro Alvarez?
Right now he is, because Carlos Santana he's not catching anymore, okay? Roberto Perez is the perfect backstop backup to Gomes. And Carlos Santana has actually shown that while third base was kind of a dicey proposition, first base he's all right. I mean, he's actually turned into a pretty good first baseman. He makes a lot of plays that I was like, hey, that's pretty good. So you're not going to put Kipnis at first base, okay? If Santana's going to play first base, where's Swisher going to play?
I mean, he's got a DH.
Yeah, if he doesn't DH, he's got to be in the outfield.
Right.
We've already got Bourne and Brantley and Murphy and Rayburn. I mean, it's kind of, they have a little bit of a logjam. And the problem is, Kipnis and Chisenhall and maybe Bourne and Murphy, but I mean, really, Kipnis and Chisenhall and Aviles just aren't good defenders anymore. Or at this point, I should say, because two of them are young. Kipnis and Chisenhall aren't good defenders right now. Aviles is just not really a good defender anymore.
Right.
And they have all these guys under contract and not enough places for them to play.
Well, I mean, I think we saw what Kipnis' potential is last season. I mean, that was a monster season he had last season.
With the bat. Right,
with the bat. And, I mean, let's be honest, that's really all that matters when you're talking about value in baseball. Like, if you can hit, they're going to find somewhere for you to play. Don't worry about that.
That's kind of the first thing that came out of your mouth. If Kipnis hits like he used to hit, quote-unquote, last year, basically, because he's a young player, putting him in left field is a tolerable proposal. But if he's going to hit like he did this year,
yeah.
You don't want that guy playing left field.
Right.
I mean, for as much as everyone complains about Michael Bourne, it's kind of a toss-up between Michael Bourne and Jason Kipnis right now. And I would say Michael Bourne, even with his age, is a better outfielder than Jason Kipnis.
One would think.
So, I mean, Kipnis this year hit .241 with 6 homers and 41 RBI.
That's bad.
I mean, Bourne had 3 home runs. Come on. I just think it's going to be really interesting. I mean, there's reports, I saw one today, of like, well, maybe you have to really talk about dealing Lindor.
That kind of made my stomach turn a little bit.
I know, but what the Indians fans at least allege that they need is that big right-handed power bat. Right? They need like a Justin Upton. They need like a Paul Goldschmidt, right?
Yeah.
So could you convince, and not necessarily those guys, but that's like the caliber we're talking about, could you convince a team, like the Diamondbacks, say, to trade you Goldschmidt for Lindor plus who knows?
Yeah, I mean, when you're dealing with those premier players, I think we learned when, you know...
I mean, it's probably going to be like Lindor and Salazar and, I don't know, Tyler Naquin.
Right.
It's an idea. I don't think I like it, though.
Yeah, that would be very interesting to see. That would kind of take us to that whole back to that whole Stanton discussion that we were having earlier in the season with the Pirates and Giancarlo Stanton.
Right. I think at this point, I mean, 250 at bats from Ramirez it's an impressive thing that he's done, but it's not enough to sell Francisco Lindor off.
No, that is a very, very tiny sample size indeed.
I mean, if you want to go ahead and say, like, we feel really comfortable with Jose Ramirez, so we're going to trade Eric Gonzalez, or we're going to trade Joey Wendell, or, you know what I mean?
Right.
Those decisions make more sense to me, but Francisco Lindor has the potential to be, like, a franchise level player, you know, a perennial Gold Glove shortstop, and those don't grow on trees.
Yes.
Change the subject a little, because I said I want to get to the starting rotation. What about the Indian starting rotation?
The Klubot has been phenomenal. The Corey Kluber Society has been in session all season long. The Klubot is... I've been saying this season, Corey Kluber's career trajectory reminds me a lot of Cliff Lee's career trajectory.
Yeah.
Like,
I agree with that.
Eerily similar. And actually, I should go take a peek at the numbers. I wanted to actually write an article to compare the two, just from a almost nonsensical point, other than to just say, like, they were both late bloomers in Cleveland. But just as kind of a fun way to connect one generation of Cleveland to another.
Right.
But that is very much who Corey Kluber reminds me of right now, because he is just straight dealing.
Right. And we've talked about the Indians' defense a lot. We all know it's individual. I saw this on FanGraphs today. Many of its individual defenders are the worst at their position, and as a collective, they are the worst defense in baseball.
Yeah, imagine if Corey Kluber had Francisco Lindor behind him all season playing defense.
Well, and this is what I'm getting to. So I think it makes sense with that in mind to kind of throw ERA out the window, right, and just focus on FIP.
Right.
Because with this defense, there's all sorts of runs being allowed that shouldn't. I mean, we've all seen all the animations on different FanGraphs articles that you can put circus music over the top. So Corey Kluber's FIP this year is 2.38. Carlos Carrasco's FIP is 2.48. Danny Salazar's FIP is 3.52. And Trevor Bauer is 3.98. And TJ House is 3.59. That's a pretty good starting rotation.
Yeah, that's a very good starting rotation. When your fifth starter has an ERA under 4, you're doing okay for yourself.
Right, and I mean, TJ House has been phenomenal, I think, since he's come up. He's done a lot more than a lot of people expected. And Trevor Bauer has really straightened things out. I mean, he still has, you know, breakdowns a young pitcher will have from time to time. I mean, just all around, that rotation is a lot of fun to watch. And if you're an Indians fan, I mean, that's something to really be excited about. Because a rotation, Kluber, Carrasco, Salazar, Bauer, and House, all those guys are really young, really under team control, really cheap, and showing that they can be really, really good.
So let me ask you this: are you officially?
Not something we could have said at the beginning of the year.
Right. Yeah. That's what I want to ask. Are you officially back on the Carlos Carrasco bandwagon? Are
at
you
the
a?
Beginning of the year, if you had told me TJ House was going to be really a really important part of the Indians' September playoff push, I would have laughed.
You would have just straight up laughed at me, huh?
But did I lose you there?
Nope. Are you still here?
Nope. Sorry.
Oh, no, you're fine.
One guy I do want to throw out, because he's had a phenomenal year. We saw him in Akron, is Kyle Crockett. He's had 41 appearances this year and has a 1.91 ERA.
That's a very good ERA, for those of you who may be unaware.
So, he's done a lot to stabilize the bullpen. But was that kind of like just smattering of, you know, picking here and picking there, which I know might not be the most entertaining thing to do, but at this point in the Indian season, there's not much else to do, right? But look back and kind of reminisce on what went right and what went wrong. What I do want to talk about, a little discussion to have here before we wind down the Indians portion, is this idea. We kind of touched on it with trading Lindor, that what the Indians need to be successful is a 3,100 bat, right? They need that big bat that can just mash and drive in runs.
Yeah, and those guys grow on trees, right?
Yeah, well, I actually started an article about this once that never got finished, so I do have some numbers about just how many of those guys have been plucked off the trees over the years. So in 2013... only 13 players in the whole MLB, you know, universe hit 30 home runs or more. In the same year, only 14 players drove in 100 or more. And in, again, 2013, there were only 9 guys that did both. And wow. Interestingly enough, only 4 of them were on teams that actually made the playoffs. And there's another stat here that I think is interesting, that the Red Sox, which led all of baseball last year with 800 runs scored, which, I mean, that's a lot of runs, okay? I mean, that's a powerhouse offense. They had one guy who hit 3,100, and that's David Ortiz. If only 9 guys in the entire league are 3,100 players, there is just no way in hell the Indians can afford one. I mean, if he doesn't grow out of the farm system, it's just not going to happen.
Right.
I mean, the days of, like, Albert Bell, who in 1995 was the first player in league history to hit 50 doubles and 50 home runs in one season, which was a strike-shortened season, that just doesn't happen anymore.
There are no more Brady Andersons hitting 50 home runs from the leadoff position. That's what you're trying to say.
Exactly. And when you think, again, about the kind of, so if we establish, you know, we're not going to be able to sign this guy in the free agent market, we don't have anyone like that in our system currently, and most teams don't, then the only way we can get one is to trade for one. So you have to wait till this guy is established, which means that by the time you get him, you're only going to get maybe 1 or 2 years of that 3,100 power. And you're going to have to give up, like we said, a Lindor, a Naquin, and, you know, maybe like a Danny Salazar or someone else. Like, Lindor and Naquin is not going to be enough.
Right.
I mean, the thought of it just boggles my mind. You hear about all these people. I mean, the A's are in a playoff slide right now. And everyone on ESPN is saying it's because they traded Yoenis Cespedes. It couldn't be further from the truth. The problem is their whole offense is in a giant slump. Their best offensive player over the last week is Sam Fold.
And that's never a good thing.
It doesn't matter if you put Yoannis Cespedes in there. Yoannis Cespedes doesn't get on base. He strikes out a ton. If the only guy he's got to hit in is Sam Fold, then you lose every game 2-1 instead of 2-0.
Right.
One player is not enough. I mean, when you look at the Indians' offense, like what they're trying to do, they're trying, much like the Pirates have done, to build a team where every player is getting on base, like at a 100, you know, points higher, or like a 315 and above clip. And really, if you throw out Jason Kipnis's numbers and Nick Swisher, because Swisher's a total tank job this year. They're actually pretty close. They had the seventh. They had the seventh most runs scored in the American League, with arguably their best offensive player from last year, Jason Kipnis, stinking, and one of their giant free agent signings stinking.
Yeah, I mean that's not a bad season considering everything that went wrong, which was a lot of things offensively.
Right, I'm not saying, you know, always just sit and rest on their laurels. I just think it's not as bad as people want to believe, you know? And the idea that we can just go out and pluck a Justin Upton or a Paul Goldschmidt off the free agent market or from another team for, like, a bag of balls and a double-A prospect just isn't going to happen.
Yeah, this is not fantasy baseball.
Right. So, just things to think about, you know. This is kind of like the post birth ramblings of a new father. It's kind of like disjointed, but there's good points in there.
You just gotta get through them because you've been up since 8 o'clock the day before, changing right. Diapers.
Yeah, you know, just things to think about. Things of note that have occurred to me over the end of this season.
As you've been sitting up at 4 a.m.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I like that. That's I like. We should make that a daddy rambling segment.
There you go. You know, I think my son was like 4 days old, and we watched our first Indians game, and it was at 2:30 a.m. So that's just kind of like where I'm coming from here.
That's. To put things in perspective, that does lend a little bit of it.
Yeah.
So anything else with Cleveland? Is that it? We talked about quite a bit with Cleveland.
Yeah, well, you know, we haven't talked in a while.
It's been a long time. We had quite a bit to talk about.
But you've got some tweet mails, I think.
Well, we have an outstanding tweet mail. So we're going to jump to the tweet mails now.
Tweet mails.
And our tweet mail today is from our good friend Dan in Buffalo, who a few weeks ago had actually brought up this topic, and I thought it was kind of interesting. He wanted us to revisit the next time that we, Jason and I, had a discussion about our debate about our top two prospects from each of our respective organizations. So if you're unfamiliar, every season Jason and I do a countdown of Cleveland and Pittsburgh's top 20 prospects. And then we get Bob the mediator to mediate a discussion about which two prospects are the better of the two. So he wanted us to revisit last season when our top two prospects were that we were talking about were Gerrit Cole and Jameson Taillon versus Cleveland's Trevor Bauer and Francisco Lindor. So he wanted to know in that debate I came out on top. Full disclosure, I was the to the victor go the spoils. And so he wanted us to revisit that at this point in time and see if we still feel that holds up. So I don't know, Jason, would you like to lead off your point? Or maybe you agree that I was correct in being awarded the victor in that debate.
Well, I think the interesting thing about the argument, right, is that, wait, so it was Talion and Cole versus Lindor and Bauer?
Yes.
So, Bauer and Cole now are both in the majors, although Cole has one more season, and is, at this point, a better pitcher. I won't argue that. I mean, he was much more dominant even last year than Bauer is this year, although he had, you know, he had his rough spots this year, which is to be expected for a second-year player. But so Cole, at this point, is better than Bauer. Lindor succeeded in Double-A, and then after about a week or two, which is his norm, seemed to make a solid adjustment to Triple-A. And seems to be primed to make that leap to the majors, whereas Talion has this troubling arm injury. I think it's, it's almost a push.
It's a, you know, I've been staring at this for basically like the whole podcast, kind of thinking about how I would frame art. And I kind of have to agree with you. I really do think, it's kind of, we're in a holding pattern with this.
Because Cole pushed Bauer. There's no argument there. Yet, the other, pitchers are so fragile. And Talion is rehabbing from a fairly serious injury. Not one that people don't come back from, just a significant injury, whereas his comparison mate is, you know, succeeding in the minors, but hasn't yet, you know, had the opportunity to provide any real value to the club.
Yes, but is clearly on his way up at 19 years old and in AAA.
Right.
I think we have to agree. Sorry, Dan, but we're going to have to push this one.
Dan's not gonna be happy.
Dan will not be happy. If we have to make a statement, Jason, I'm gonna go ahead and say I think I am the victor still in this debate because I'm getting the most major league production from my half of the duo. That's what I said.
Yes, well, and I think you also, you know, like, If say, like, Chris were here making a legal argument, you were the victor of the first round, and the second round failed to unseat the winner of the first round, ipso facto, you still are the winner.
I remain the victor. You made a very good case for me to remain the victor still. Thank you for that. I appreciate that.
No problem.
That was a very good argument on my behalf. You would have made a good attorney.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. It's never too late to make a career change. Just kind of keep that in the back of your mind. So I think that's going to wrap it up for today. We covered everything that we wanted to talk about. That was a good podcast. It was good to have you back. I missed you. I really did.
I missed being here.
So, it's going to be kind of sporadic for us. It's a hectic time of year with me going back to work and Jason having a baby to take care of. But when we do have the chance to post something, you can go check it out on our website at www.tsmbaseball.com. You can email us, tristatebb@tsmbaseball.com. You can follow us on the Twitter, @tristatebb. And you can check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/TSM Baseball. So for Jason Ruggiero, this is Andy Burdick, and we look forward to talking to you soon.